You're now listening to Sound Talent Media. Check out more shows at soundtalentmedia.com.
Hello and welcome back to the podcast. This is your host, Tom May, and this is Future Friday. Today I'm welcoming my dear friend, Kaylee Goldsworthy, to the show. She is a musician and a songwriter living here in Philadelphia. Today we talk about classical music backgrounds and bringing that into punk rock. We talk about touring in Russia, songwriting, and finally my favorite, we got into the spooky side of things, a little Syracuse urban legend, a little Scranton urban legend. Talk tarot cards as a mental and creative exercise, which I thought was pretty fascinating and eye-opening as a kind of way to break out of the monotony of creativity sometimes. We're talking about building relationship with your fans in this wild-ass dystopian novel that has become our current life. It was a great conversation, and I hope you enjoy it. You can check out Kaylee at Kaylee Goldsworthy and check out the Kaylee G Show on Twitch, as well as Kaylee's numerous recordings that you can hear anywhere music is streamed. I want to thank everybody who's been sending me emails. I really appreciate that. Some really cool ideas that I'm going to follow through with. I met some people over email that I'm going to have as guests. I'm very excited. So thank you very much to Kaylee for coming on. Kaylee Goldsworthy. Awesome. Kaylee, thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you for having me.
Hell yeah. I'm super excited about this conversation. I want to ask you about your life and your musical journey and your journey now with your TV show and stuff. But I was hoping out of the gate, maybe you could talk about what it was like to go to Russia. So I've heard some things that you've said before, and I've heard most of your stories and experiences third hand, but I just find it such a fascinating place that's been on my list for so long. I was hoping you could tell me about
sure.
it.
Sure. Going into it, we were kind of like prepared for the worst. It's no reflection of the country itself, but I know from a touring band perspective that it can be quite grueling. And Frank's previous tour was very difficult, and we knew that. It was very arduous. They did most of their transportation via train. And with, as you know, with any amount of gear, that's just sounds like a fucking nightmare.
That sounds like a nightmare. And just to set the stage for everybody, you're on tour in Russia with Frank Iero. Now you guys are taking a train and you're lugging equipment just like...
I mean, this was not me. This was his previous iteration of the band. But that is what we had known about his trip to Russia previous. So that was like the only story that we had to prepare for this trip was that overall the shows were great, but like all of the rest of it was just very unenjoyable and kind of clunky and very stressful. And I talked to Frank about it last I spoke with him, and he kind of felt bad because honestly, I had a blast in Russia. I thought it was fantastic. That being said, we also only played a handful of shows. Like we made it a week-long tour, I think, where we played St. Petersburg, we played Moscow, we did a festival in Ukraine, and then we kind of lumped it into a couple of festivals in the UK on our way in and out. So it was a very short stint in Russia, whereas his last tour was like extended, like taking trains through Siberia, that kind of thing. And once you got in, I think the hardest part of the trip was customs, because customs sucks any country you're going into, but for some reason, Russia is very, very specific about the specifics. And we had all of the documentation needed. And I mean, truly, we had to get all kinds of work visas. And the timelines didn't make any sense. Like, I remember Phil actually had to bring me, like, your Phil had to bring me my Russian visa and passport to the, I think, your Crossroads show. Yeah, because it was the day before I left for Russia. They did not give us our passports back until the day before we were supposed to leave.
Having your passport is a lot different, especially when you're in a foreign country, but even in the States. I don't know how it is for you, but for a lot of people, I'm sure, it's kind of the thing that I leave it in a fire safe. I don't have it anywhere else. It's like if you lose it, you're just fucked. So you have this like emotional security attachment to it. It's just a book with pieces of paper, but you're like, I need this. It's held in the minds of countries and bureaucrats so highly that you just respect it. It's not like a driver's license or something. But
especially in Pennsylvania, like it's not even considered a real form of ID. Like, come on, man. Passport is king.
Your passport is king. So, but to get a visa, a lot of people think of a visa, you might have a separate paper or something. But normally, a visa is you send your passport to the embassy of the country that you're going to, and then they put a thing with, like, your picture, maybe not, or the specifics inside of your passport. And then they hold it, and then they send it back to you. So you're saying you didn't get it back till the day before you had to go to Russia?
The day before we were supposed to leave. And so it was just, like, a very stressful... Like, we all didn't even know if it was going to happen until we all got our passports back. Which
just
is just
the tone for the trip.
Insane. Yeah, exactly. So we finally got there, and then customs held on to us for, like, easily 2 to 3 hours. I distinctly remember Frank going, if you're not going to let us in, just tell us and we'll leave. And I being like, oh, my God, this is an actual conversation that we're having with customs officials in Russia. Like, just let us leave. And it got to the point where, like, they we had to uncase everything and show them the serial numbers of everything and show that they matched every article that we were bringing with us. And they gave us difficulties because we didn't have the serial numbers of all of our pedals.
Wow.
And so it was kind of like, at this point, before we even got in, we were like, yeah, I understand why this was stressful. Sure. And kind of a nightmare. And it has no reflection of actually Russia itself, but just all of the struggles that a touring band has to endure to get into the foreign country.
Totally.
So eventually we finally got through, and then we were in, and honestly, it was incredible. It was just awesome. The food was super great. The people were incredibly kind. Not a lot of people spoke English, whereas I know, like, you tour a lot all over in mainland Europe, and you're kind of like, you know, most people will speak some small amount of English so that they can communicate with you, sing along, things like that.
Yeah.
A lot less of that in Russia than I'd ever experienced before. So it was a little difficult in trying to communicate with other people.
Sure.
And I also always try and learn a little bit of whatever language I'm going into if it's not an English speaking country. But I also never thought I'd be going to Russia. So I was never quite on my radar to learn too much Russian.
Sure.
But they make amazing, we call them pierogies here, but they're just called dumplings there.
Mm-hmm.
Like the potato dumplings. And they also have this dessert one called a cherry dumpling.
Oof.
And we all would just order them at every restaurant we went to, and like they'd all, I guess it's supposedly some like shared appetizer, but because we're Americans and we're animals, we all ordered a plate of them ourselves.
Yeah, we don't get the family style concept there. It's just like,
yeah.
I'm getting this.
So we got a lot of looks while we were there. We took the overnight train between St. Petersburg and Moscow. So that was cool. We had like our own little Wes Anderson moment where we did have to like rush to get all of our stuff onto the train. But we also, I believe we had someone else driving separately so that we could not have it be as stressful.
Sure, yeah, move the gear.
Yeah, so that was a cool experience to have too, like to be on an overnight train, sleep on a train.
Yeah, that's incredible. That's like on the bucket list for me. Would
yeah.
surely be to take an overnight train in Russia. Like that's just the environment.
The only thing that sucked about it, because I completely agree with you, it wasn't my bucket list, but it was overnight, so I never saw a single thing.
Ah, true. So you're just relying on the atmosphere of the actual train of like the people that come and go and yeah.
So it was very much I do think that I would like to go on an extended train trip if I were to ever go back into Russia so that I could actually see what it looks like outside of the train. But yeah, I mean we did the whole dinner on the dinner cart.
Amazing.
It was very quaint and it felt very special because again, Russia is not a place that you think you're ever going to be fortunate enough to go to and play music.
Exactly. Especially with the way, well, more modern times politically, we've like reverted back to a Red Scare kind of vibe in some regards. And the kind of othering and they of, you know, Russian government and by default, subconsciously, maybe Russian people and culture, which you try not to. But yeah, it's so funny because the way that I think of Russia is from their literature and culture. But also the way that I've pictured visually going there is all informed by like you know, Bourne movies and old 80s Cold War spy movies. So you just picture it using really cool tones. Everything's gray and brutal architecture with snow everywhere. But I imagine that it's probably
not.
Actually.
It's not. It's so beautiful. Yeah. I was surprised, and I also felt very naive because I did not realize that St. Petersburg was just, there's water everywhere.
Yeah.
And it's beautiful. And I guess, again, I usually try and do my due diligence, but it just, that year we toured so much that I never really prepared myself and kind of gave myself the crash course in Russian geography and architecture and things I would want to see because it just kind of came up so fast. But we were walking around these beautiful areas in St. Petersburg, and like I saw a wedding happen outside of a castle. I took so many pictures. We walked around Moscow after dark and got kicked out by the police just because we wanted to try and see anything and everything we possibly could while we were there.
Totally. That's amazing.
Yeah.
I always found Russia really fascinating. Besides the 20th century political things that happened there, it's also been historically, you know, a Eurasian place. They take parts of culture that you would normally find in like East Asian culture, a little bit of cuisine. There's so many different people in Russia as well. They'd be like, oh, Russian's one thing, a monoculture is absurd. But, you know, there's the European influence from Peter the Great and everything in St. Petersburg, and then also the Asian influence that kind of meets together, and it's just a unique place. Like, I always picture it. One of my favorite parts about going to a new place on tour, especially hit hard in Australia when we went, and in South America, is that the nature that you see, even driving from the airport to the city, it's all trees that you've seen in pictures and trees that you've seen in real life, but something seems subtly different. There's like slightly different species, or the birds are slightly different, so it kind of throws your mind into a different place, and I'm
That's
really hoping
really
that that
point.
Happens in Russia as well.
Yeah, no, it definitely will, and you're absolutely right, because I'd wake up early and walk around wherever we were staying, and the architecture is just like, you notice those Eastern Asian influences, and it's just, it's not something that clicks because you're like, oh, I'm in Russia, and then, but like you said, it's so like kind of linear to think that it's just Russian culture in Russia.
Yeah, exactly.
And I think whenever we're elsewhere that we've maybe already been or have a bit of familiarity, you see those subtleties in the culture itself. But never having been to Russia and then seeing Russia, it took actually some time to like truly appreciate how Russian and how not Russian it was, if that makes sense.
That makes total sense.
Okay, cool.
Oh yeah, like walking around in Hollywood or something that you're so familiar with, but actually not actually familiar with at all.
Yeah.
I'll bet. So what? Tell me about where you came up, like why you're sitting here today. You know, like what some people may or may not know, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, is that you started learning music on the violin.
I did, yeah. Nice. I started in the third grade, and
I actually also started violin fourth and fifth grade. I took a very, very long break and didn't keep with it, but that was my first exposure to learning to play an instrument as well.
And is that why you've decided to start picking it back up again?
It is, yeah, totally.
That's awesome.
Totally. But yeah, so you started in third grade.
And I just didn't stop. And it was also the only instrument, like you had to pick a stringed instrument if you wanted to play an instrument in the third grade. And then in the fourth grade, you could go to whatever band instrument you wanted to play.
Sure.
So like my sister also started playing the violin, but then in fourth grade, she switched to the flute and then stayed there. But I just loved the violin. And I don't know. There was just something about it that made me want to keep doing it. And then before I left elementary school, I joined the Syracuse Symphony Youth Orchestra. And
very cool.
Yeah, it was amazing. And I didn't think about how amazing it was until I got older, because I played a concert with Michael Kamen when I was in fifth grade.
Wow.
The guy who did Lethal Weapon and toured with Pink Floyd, like, in the fifth grade. And it was just something that, obviously, being like the Syracuse Symphony is a fantastic and very, very good orchestra. I grew up very fortunate to have access to that kind of level of musicianship. And also, many of my private teachers were in the symphony. But then to be able to have access to audition for and learn how to be in a larger symphony, like the youth orchestra, that was a lot. It also was my first lesson in politics. because I
any large supposedly meritocratic organization is never so.
I played in that symphony for so long, and honestly, I wanted so badly to excel there and like go up seats every year, and I learned that the conductor liked when you memorized the pieces so you could be looking at her. So I memorized every piece, and every year I never got up further than where I was at. And I found out that all of her students were at the front and everybody else was behind. And after that, I left my first rehearsal. I think I was in the sixth grade, and I was like, "Mom, I think I'm done." And
she was damn.
Like, and then she totally was like, "That's fine. Keep the folder," because the folder was like a $50 deposit.
Ah, no shit. Yeah, that's a fantastic mom response.
Screw them.
Yeah. It's funny. I think there's two stories in there that you just highlighted. One of them being that the experience of playing with Mike. Well, sorry, what was his last name?
Michael Kamen.
So that experience hooked into you, like that opened the door, kept you like excited about it. And I think that a lot of people in the creative field can point to similar experiences that young, that age, like fourth, fifth, sixth grade. Even my friends that are like geologists can be like, "Oh yeah, you know, we went to this." Somebody was telling me recently that became a geologist that they had run into a thing at Knoebels amusement park that was like fool's gold and a bunch of other shit, and that just stuck with them forever. But this experience, amazing that you ran into that. But then in the same breath, you run into something that completely pushes you away from it, and that is surprise, a person will, you know, willfully or ignorantly or whatever, being a complete asshole.
Yeah, I think, but I think it was also like such an important, exactly what you're saying. It was so important because it was like two sides of the same coin, where like I had this unbridled passion towards playing music because it was so cool to watch a composer. And I still, to this day, I actually started doing more research on learning how to score films, because he conducted us while sitting at a grand piano and playing. And we played the theme from Circle of Friends, which was like an old Minnie Driver movie. But the theme is so beautiful. And I don't ever remember having felt music so intensely at such a young age than being kind of like in the organ. You know what I mean? Where like usually you're listening to music and you're watching it happen. But I was like feeling the music while it was happening, and I was playing it and I was in it. And I just thought it was so cool. And also like wanting to make sure that no matter what I did with music, that like I made whatever, you know, violin for all intents and purposes is sometimes a nerdy instrument once you get into high school. Yeah. I never wanted it to be that, because it's so powerful and it's so cool.
Yeah, I feel like that dragon is what we're, as musicians, constantly chasing after, is that
absolutely
complete immersion, being you are the music in a lot of sense, and that's what absolutely makes the live show so good, which we can't have, which is why we're here talking.
And then at the same time, it also taught me that no matter how hard you try, sometimes life's not fair.
Yeah. In fact, these days I'm starting to be inclined to think that the definition of life is unfairness, suffering, and that we should just embrace it.
I feel like learning to navigate the things that you can't control that lead
exactly
to suffering.
The only sureness in life is what they say, death and taxes. But I guess if you don't ever make money, you wouldn't pay taxes, but you're definitely going to die. Sorry, you were right about to start talking about the high school kind of situation that happens with classical music. So I went back to playing violin again in high school in 11th and 12th grade. I was extremely lucky that I had an incredible teacher, Miss McConnellogue, that allowed me to be the only person to take a music theory 2 class. So I got to sit in a room by myself and take it while the other people were taking the first class. She'd come in the morning and give me the assignment. But just having her as a teacher was amazing. But I did see what kind of happened with violin and orchestra in high school, where it became kind of sterile in a sense, or like competitive in a way that wasn't necessarily about the music.
Sure.
You know, I understand that the best of the best should rise, and that you should be, you know, celebrate how someone can be fucking incredible, but it kind of like took some of the music out of music. And I don't know if you experienced the same thing.
Absolutely. And I also think that you kind of touch on a really important part that plays a role in anyone who enjoyed music in high school, and it's the teacher. Because my high school teacher, Mr. Brin, was the coolest. And I mean, there's a degree of not funness that happens when you're in high school with especially with symphony or band or any kind of classical iteration of music that you choose to pursue. I always valued, and I took with him, the fact that he really leaned into what we thought was cool. So, like, and also I loved him, and we got along really well. So I would also kind of, I was concert master, and I would always be like, yo, you know, it'd be really cool, the Jurassic Park theme song, we should totally play that. And then like, you know, the next year we'd play the Jurassic Park theme song or something like that. So that it was actually like something that we all looked forward to playing. And even as a music instructor, that when I would teach kids on my own in the years following, like, it was always like, okay, once you master this Beethoven piece, we're going to learn whatever song you want to learn from the radio, you know?
Yeah.
Because keeping people inspired is the only way to keep them on that path. Because otherwise, yeah, like, it's bland otherwise.
Yeah, totally. And now that I'm older, I wonder what went into all of that. You know, it's great to have the transaction of it where we'll get the kids to do the hard thing so they can do the other thing. I wonder how much of it is like, well, the family that bought all the violins wants to hear the Beethoven right. thing when they come to see us, so we better make sure that happens.
Yeah.
Another part of the classical kind of training, I don't even know if I'm using classical in the right context, but the school training of band and orchestral kind of stuff, at least in my experience, some of the people who were the best weren't able to jam. I think yes. There was a little bit of a dichotomy or a crossroads that split, because you knew people that aren't, I know people, I mean, I can't read sheet music well today. I definitely can't sight read while I play guitar or piano or violin or anything like that. But there's people I knew that were in my orchestra that were really fucking good, like amazing. They were just blazing through shit. They were going to get scholarships and stuff. Mm-hmm. But we would jam. I'd have left an acoustic guitar in the room and be like, all right, well, I'm going to play, you know, these chords. Why don't you play something? And they would just be like, I don't know.
I continued to study violin through college, and I studied violin performance at Fredonia State in Western New York, which in and of itself is super cool because Dave Fredman's studio is there. So there was always like no shortage of incredible bands coming through and recording.
Amazing.
In Fredonia. But yeah, I learned really early on that some of the best people in the symphony, best people in the band, like, anyone can learn to read music, but not everybody knows how to hear it. And that's something that whenever I was teaching music, because I caught on to this really early on, that if you learn how to, you know, anybody can go to guitarwhatever.com and find the tab for whatever song they want to learn or the chords for whatever song they want to learn.
Sure.
But not everybody approaches music like, I'm going to listen to this Ramon song and I'm going to figure out the chords before I look online.
Yeah.
I want to hear the chords. I want to hear how the difference in those two chords when they move from one to the other. And I want to be able to figure out what that difference is and how to play it.
Yeah.
And I think that, and it's no disrespect to the people who can only read music, because they are, some of them are eons better than I will ever be at the instrument. But if you start playing a song and expect them to play along with you, it'll never happen.
Yeah.
And I was always really fascinated by that. You know, obviously being at a music conservatory, like, there were the jazz majors who excelled in both of them immensely.
Sure.
But
the savants.
Yes, exactly. But I did find that there were a handful of people who kind of like drove straight down the middle. Like, I was not in the bottom half of my class in violin, but I was not, you know, the top either. But I was that kind of unique individual who also could jam with my friends.
Sure.
And just like jump right in. And it's funny because even as I've gotten older, I've played the guitar almost as long as the violin and sang, you know, longer than both of them. But the violin is the instrument that I feel the most comfortable on. Like, if anybody starts playing a song, I don't have perfect pitch, but I'm a half step off. So
sure.
Usually, like, I'll land on the note first or second time and just kind of go with it. Yeah.
Yeah, and then by then you can get the scales. Because that was, like, you know, one thing I ended up telling people was, okay, well, this is in G major, and I know that you've practiced the G major scale for hours, so just pick any note in the scale and just play it whenever you feel like it.
Yep.
Try to shake somebody into that. I don't think it's necessarily the fairest analogy, but it's almost kind of like the difference between cooking and just following the recipe. So, like, you know,
that's a really good analogy, I think.
Yeah, like people who taste the sauce while you're cooking it, or you can just follow the recipe. Because if you follow the recipe, you could be really fucking good. You know, if the recipe is great, then the food's going to be great if you follow it perfectly. But you know, if you want to make it taste how you want to taste it for you or for what you got going on, you know, that's I feel kind of pompous pulling that. But I think I've done enough cooking the last year and a half at my house that I'm now an expert. Well, I'm not an expert, but I have fun.
You're an expert in your house.
I'm an expert in my house. Yeah, I know where every utensil is, mostly. Actually, I usually have to ask Beth Ann where some of them are. But,
man, if I was still selling Pampered Chef,
I'd be signed up. So you had a great solo career going. You make awesome music. You have the Kaylee G Show, correct? Is what you're calling it?
Yeah,
yep. And when you are working on that now. Recently, I know you've played in a lot of bands, your own and with other people. I was wondering, as somebody who's played in the same band for almost 15 years now, how does playing with all of those other musicians inform your personal songwriting? Are you able to kind of like notice what somebody's doing and then take that or subconsciously move it? Or is it like...
Yeah, yes and no, honestly. And thank you, by the way, that was very kind. I really enjoy playing with other bands because I have always felt, especially ever since I decided to do solo music, I kind of hate solo songwriting. Like, and by kind of hate, I mean I fucking hate solo songwriting. I love working and riffing off of other people. And if I'm writing a song and I'm the only person in the room writing the song, I have the way that I write every song, and it gets really redundant. And so I've learned that in touring with other bands, not only does it help inspire, you know, like, for example, Bayside, their chord structures are so much more complex than I ever thought that they were, just from as a listener, for example.
Yeah.
Because they're like this cool pop punk rock band that, you know, they all, the songs are very straightforward, cool. They, like, Anthony has a really cool inflection in the percussiveness of his lyrics and his phrasing, which I really admire and enjoy. But then every once in a while, they'll throw in a chord or a bridge that is just so unexpected.
Yeah.
And having to learn all of their songs, you know, I would catch on and be like, oh, I get it. We're doing this thing that they do.
So right there, you mean this thing that they do, it could be like, so we've all got these tricks, and we've got ones that we hammer into the ground, and you're talking about, oh, after the chorus, this is the chord. You know, you go to the relative minor and
exactly.
To the fourth or whatever, like that kind of shit. You're like, oh, that's, and it's what makes a Bayside song sound like a Bayside song.
Yeah, and it's that thing that you didn't put your finger on until you actually had to kind of like dissect it. And so I've been fortunate enough to do that with a lot of different bands. And before I even took the plunge into solo work and hired gun stuff, like back in 2013, I was a hired gun for a band called Young and Sick that was on Harvest. And it was an R&B pop band. Like, I was completely in over my head. I didn't even understand the genre of music at all. It was just fun. And I love challenging myself and, like, in a completely unpretentious way, like, just I having the opportunity to play pop music, R&B music, punk music, like being in the Mermaid and having that like B3 kind of mentality, like the number of YouTube videos I watched of people playing B3 just so that I could learn like the little subtleties of it.
So cool. That's like the 10,000 hour thing that gets argued over and debunked constantly, but
yes,
you know, it's true to a degree that you, like, the Beatles played in Hamburg every day for 7 hours forever, and that's why they became the Beatles. So like you get this background and you just soak all this up and take the parts of it that you like, you know?
Yeah.
That's why like multicultural societies make the best food and art and shit. You get taking the good shit from everywhere. Like, it's the best.
So I kind of think of like myself as just kind of all of these experiences that I've gathered to not only help me craft a song, but also like how I want the song to sound, taking, you know, stealing little tidbits of things that I've learned from all of these different bands and all different genres. You know, it's I feel super, super lucky to have been able to. And it was funny because when I lived in Nashville, obviously I was friends with a lot of people who do the hired gun thing and play in a bunch of different bands too. So it was kind of fun to have those experiences with those other musicians as well.
Then I did also notice about Bayside when we toured with them, watching, being like, oh shit, these songs are, these chord progressions specifically are so much more complex than I'd realized.
Right?
I would compare it to like kind of metal movements, but with you know, nicer sounding pop stuff. And they're good, damn good guitar players. So
yes,
and every one of them is damn good. So yeah, it makes sense. So you just mentioned being in Nashville. So you've lived in a lot of places.
Yes.
And that's you know, has informed your life, I'm sure. And I've heard you on other podcasts and stuff talk about that. But to bring up Nashville, my fiance Beth Ann, whom you know intimately, loves that fucking show Nashville. Loves that kind of very like easy to digest.
On?
It is not. I think they killed all of the characters off.
Wow. Okay.
At least that's what I would assume by how upset Beth Ann was. But so I got to ask you, I hear that you are a big fan of kind of rom-com book club of the month kind of situation. Like, is this a guilty pleasure that you have, or a very non-guilty pleasure?
It's a not guilty pleasure because I feel like, especially over the past year, whatever fucking makes you happy, just like hold on to it and never let it go.
You're damn right. I agree with that wholeheartedly.
I mean, it's not something, especially touring all the time with a bunch of dudes. It's not like I'm going to be like, guys, can't we watch How to Lose a Guy in 10 Days tonight? Like, I'm tired of watching whatever fucking Star Wars, but.
Exactly. That was another thing I wanted to ask you about. I wanted to ask you about what you love about these books, but we'll bring up the touring thing in a second. But what makes them good? Like, what do you like about it?
About what? Rom-coms?
The book, yeah, rom-coms.
Okay, yeah, yeah. I just like, basically, I've never been a huge TV watcher, but when I am, like, I feel like I don't get anything done. So my problem was always, like, I would just binge watch, like, I fucking love The Bachelor and Bachelorette. I have a fantasy league. It's out of control.
A fantasy league instead of baseball, it's Bachelor.
It's The Bachelor.
Contestants?
Wow. Yep.
I've never heard of that. That's amazing.
It's just funny and it's just lighthearted and it's just kind of ridiculous. But I think honestly, reading those kinds of books just like makes me feel a little smarter for reading it instead of binge watching it. I guess.
I back that. Yeah,
is my thing. And so like I breeze through at least 2 books a month, but like I'll never tell anybody what titles they are.
That's amazing. I love that so much.
But also it's so much nicer to like kind of flex that muscle and read more and just read shit that like you'd watch on TV. Like there's that Bling Empire that's new on Netflix that I've been watching and I just can't stand it, but I also can't not watch it whenever I have the TV on. And I'm like, I'd rather read a book that is like essentially When Harry Met Sally, or you know, like something that's just kind of cute and funny and everything that you need and nothing about reality.
100%. I think that we should embrace that. A lot of times in creative circles, people kind of are pushing each other and get a little bit competitive about who can be the most highbrow, even though, you know, none of us are really highbrow. But yeah, I think reading quote things like that is fantastic. I do the same thing with like self-help books, and I love my shitty YouTube videos. But it's interesting what you say to exercise that muscle in your brain while reading. I know some people beat themselves up because they don't read very often. And,
well,
you know, that's fine.
I used to beat myself up because I'd only read nonfiction because I thought I had to learn anytime
exactly.
I was reading.
You're like, well, I have to have a goal in mind. I can't just sit here in my room and, you know, technically, telepathically communicate with the author in the past and hallucinate what they're saying. But
and after 2020, I was like, if I have one more fucking person telling me how to live my life, even if it's going to benefit it, even if it's going to make it better. Like, I started reading that book, Burnout, about burnout, and I got burnt out reading the book. And I was like, I can't do this right now.
Yeah, I've backed that 100%, and I totally relate to that. So before you mentioned about how you didn't want, you know, you're touring with a bunch of guys is not something you'd be able to just pop on When Harry Met Sally, that kind of situation. So I know a lot of my friends that are female musicians, the trope of being asked by interviewers about like, well, what's it like being a girl band, et cetera, can get into the territory of being, you know, more malicious than just corniness. You know, it can be like carry all kinds of weight with it. But with that long caveat, what is it like in a or what are some of the thoughts and feelings that you have about being a woman in what is traditionally and currently still is a pretty male-centric space, even if just by reality. Like, most of the people who are on tour in punk rock in this kind of rock situation are going to be guys.
Yeah, I mean, I only have, like, my reality to base it off of, in which case I'm used to it. So sure. I kind of, like, have figured out how to kind of navigate and know that I'm pretty much going to be the only girl. And I've, you know, having been in a band for as long as I have been, I did at one point have a band with my sister, so I had her. But then outside of that, it was, you know, it definitely has its good, bad, and ugly aspects of it. And I think at this point in my life, at this age, and with how much I've done in my career, I feel confident that I'm able to make better decisions for myself. I'm nice. Able to pick and be more picky about the projects that I will say yes to, about the people I would choose to tour with, whereas maybe in the past, taking the opportunities that are presented to you, and then obviously having to deal with any fallout from, like, any slight red flags that arose mm-hmm. in any of the conversations I've had previous or experiences, things like that, but not delving too much into, like, the bleaker territory. I feel, you know, very confident that I'm at a point in my life where I'm able to make the right decisions for me. And honestly, I've only worked with, like, really respectful people. And also, thank God, I wasn't touring as much when I was, like, in my early 20s, because they're all, like, men now. You know what I mean? Like, they're yeah. all, like, 35-plus
yeah.
men.
Yeah, grown-ups. So, like, yeah. actual, you know, men, men, not boys, which yeah. is a case for us in a lot of ways. And, you know, everybody that we toured with, it was, yeah, judgment-free, just kind of, like, analyzing what exactly is that like? You know, what is... What are the implications?
It's close quarters. It's real close quarters.
Oh, yeah. It's like being on a submarine, you know? Like, you're just kind of... You don't have... It's like... privacy is just not a thing. Like, you know, mm-hmm. everything that you do, everybody knows when you take a shit. Everybody knows, like, what's happening. Everyone eats together for the most part. And especially in those early days where no one had any money, you couldn't do anything independently because you completely relied on each other for literally sustenance. So you kind of, like...
Yeah.
I was like, all right, well, how are we doing this? And just... Yeah, and even now, as we're all grown, it also is just very close. You got to be next to somebody.
I think also being a very independent person was something that, like, really... And maybe, you know, I'm not sure which came first, the chicken or the egg in that, because maybe I became independent because I needed to, like, be able to separate myself from the rest of the group. Sure. But I've always been the kind of person that, like, will on day one, because I'm also a female and an over-communicator, be like, yo, guys... If you guys go to eat without me because I'm not here, I'm not going to be pissed. Just like I'm going to assume that you're not going to be pissed if I go off and do my own thing. Yeah. And that
is that
kind
the
of...
equivalent of walking in and beating up the biggest guy there, like in jail? So he's going to come in and set it up on day one?
I think it was just, you know, also it's so being in a band and touring in a band, like there is such this like group mentality where like everyone has to do... Everyone does everything together. Everyone waits for everyone else. And I think that that's beautiful and I think that that's great. However, once you reach a certain point where, like, there is enough free time, like, if you're fortunate enough to tour on a bus, if you're fortunate enough to, like, have a few hours between sound check and when you have to be back to stage, yeah. You know, you don't always... If there's a place I want to eat, I'm going to tell the band, this is where I want to eat. If you're going to join me, sick. If you're not, that's fine too. But like, I'm going to leave now.
Yeah, this is the time I'm going.
Otherwise, you're going to wait 45 minutes for the last person to put his shoes on. And then he's going to be like, oh, I don't want that.
Yeah, exactly. Or do what I had done many times, look at the menu and then leave everybody there, which I don't give a fuck about. I'm just like, you know, I love you guys. I'm with you 24 hours, but I'm out.
You gotta do what you got to do because like personal happiness, especially when you're in that like pressure cooker of a bus, a van, whatever. And I think that that's probably something that saved my ass multiple times over is just the ability to be fine if I wanted to do something different than everybody else.
Yeah, hell yeah. Speaking of putting a positive note on something that is negative, just by definition, do you have anything that you take into consideration or any advice for saying no? So you mentioned that you don't know which came first, the chicken or the egg, your growth as like an independent person in these social situations. And specifically, you talked about picking and choosing which projects you were going to work on. How do you say no? Because it's actually can be really difficult, especially in our world where there's a lot of people constantly trying to connect with each other to grow. You know, we're all artists collaboratively.
Yeah, I honestly, this is not like the best answer, to be completely honest with you, because I feel as though I'm only able to put myself in that situation now, where okay. I've amassed enough on my resume to know that, like, if I say no to this, it doesn't mean that it's going to be a no for everything else.
Sure.
And I do think that perhaps as a, you know, I know that it's the same regardless of your gender or how you identify, but I also know that, like, especially with women in music, it's very difficult because
absolutely
there's not as many opportunities. So for a long time, it was say yes to everything, say yes to everything, say yes to everything. And then eventually you learn, good or bad, whether or not it was a good decision for you. And I, you know, dealt and suffered through several situations where after all was said and done and I was able to separate myself from it, I was like, I would never do that again. But to put a good spin on it, I also never would have known what it was that I needed to say no to if I hadn't existed in that
yeah.
and known what it was that, like, I will not tolerate this personality. I need to make sure, like, I also have a really hard time with, especially in the hired gun realm, like, why we're all just quiet about our rates.
Oh, yeah.
Because to me, it's just like, why would we, if we all knew what everybody else was going for, like, we'd all make more money.
Are you threatening to unionize right now?
Maybe.
That's maybe a running joke in our band of, like, the crew is going to unionize, and then we'll have to have negotiations with them, and yeah.
I mean, I just feel like, especially with women in music, like, we undervalue ourselves. I continue to undervalue myself. I made a joke to a friend of mine who was like, hey, would you like to get some freelance graphic design work? And I was like, yeah. And he's like, but I'm only going to give it to you if you promise to do the going rate. And I was like, joke's on you, I don't know the going rate. So
yeah, that is definitely a weird unspoken part about all of this. Not only because the money is, like, sporadic in and of itself, like, a lot
sure.
of times, you know, we don't know how much money you're getting. Well, you do know, but you don't have a lot of money for a project. Sometimes you have a lot of money for a project. Sometimes a tour is going to pay very well. Sometimes it's not. So it's all kind of like feeling and going back and forth. But the whole unspoken part of it has always been uncomfortable to me.
Same. And what's funny, too, is that it doesn't even necessarily amount to the money, per se, because it's more so just about the transparency of the transaction. Whereas, like, in some sure. instances, there would be projects that I would happily do for half of what I would do for other people's projects.
Yeah.
And I think to that degree, you know, it's your own personal decision as to how much you'd like to be able to do for this specific thing. But in a lot of other situations, especially with touring, you know, I do think that you need to kind of find your value and stick to it to some degree. And again, it's going to take a lot of less than gigs or free
yeah.
gigs in order to actually give yourself the power to say no. But I think that's the ultimate how you learn to say no, is that you say yes to too much, and then when you finally have the resume that enables you to be like, if I say no to this, it sucks, but there will be other opportunities because I'm out there.
Thank you for that answer. Thanks for summing it up too. I like that, because it's difficult to say no sometimes. Sometimes you just want to be agreeable as well. You don't want to, like, put someone in a position to take it personally. But then I'm sure, as you've noticed, as we've gotten older, that the people who take something like that personally, it's not good. Like, you don't want to necessarily work with them anyway.
Yeah.
It's just not good behavior. Like, it's not love. It's not from a loving place. It's not like, yeah.
Right. And also, again, it's kind of like one of those things where you sometimes have to knock people off their high horse if they're, like, ever like, you know, what does this person think about me? And you're like, yo, nobody thinks about you. And it's not a bad thing. It's just, like, nobody spends their time thinking about you. And you have to, like, use that as a point of strength. And it's the same thing in music, because it's like, yo, if you say no to this job, they're just going to find someone else.
Yeah.
Like, it's not going to hurt their feelings.
Totally.
They're just going to find someone else. And to some degree, the reason why you have to say yes is because you know you're replaceable. So you have to say yes. But
yeah.
then eventually you learn that you should be replaced if they're not paying you enough.
Totally. Yeah. It's growing pains in some
yep.
regards. Nowadays, we just hire our manager, Tim, to tell people no. It's it's kind of nice. So I'm kind of copping out big on that one. But recently there's been some situations where people have, like, called me or asked me something and pitched something. And I'm just like, no. Sorry. Thank you very much for thinking of me, and I really love that and respect you for doing that. And I'm kind of, you know, it's extremely flattering. Be like, hey, you think I'm good enough for this? So we talked a bunch about music stuff. I got one more music question, and then I'm hoping we can get into a little bit of weirder sure. territory, which is where I like to go. What's your writing workflow kind of technical situation look like? Like, how do you? Let's say you're going to record a demo in your house right now. What are you working with?
Like specific gear.
Yeah, sure. Like, what you got it plugged in? You have like an interface set up to a laptop,
I have an interface set up into a laptop. Cool. I use Logic. I use the Scarlett interface, that 2i2 interface. I have a handful of microphones that I've snagged from my father's studio that he currently is not using right now.
Badass. Which, side note, anybody listening to this, I'm also using a microphone right now that was from your father's studio.
Yes. Awesome. It sounds fantastic.
Favorite microphone I've ever owned. That's a TLM 103.
That's so awesome. Yeah, I'm using this baby bottle blue microphone.
Cool. Oh, yeah. Hell yeah.
Yeah. And I really like it. So I basically always have this set up, the microphone, the Scarlett, and then I just will plug into Logic. I need to become so much better at figuring out how to program drums to some shitty anything, but I'm really
just
bad
to be
at
able
it.
To go. Have you ever used the virtual drummer that's in Logic? There's nope. Oh my god! So there's virtual drummers, and each one has a name.
I have tried.
Have you tried it?
I've
Kyle,
tried it.
I think
I just
is the
don't
West
like
Coast
it.
Guy. Oh yeah, no.
I hate it great. So much. Yeah. Even for the theme song for my show, I like struggled for like weeks. I was pushing it off in meetings because they're like, "Why don't you have the theme song yet?" And it was because I was like, I can't drum. And then like, duh, I live with a fucking drummer. I just went downstairs and I was like, yo, Joe, I need to go for a run. Can you just like give me 8 bars of something that sounds like this? And then he did Amazing. It in like 5 minutes. And I was like kicking myself because why did I waste so much fucking time just stressing over it?
It's just kind of a throwback to what you said about being writing by yourself, which mm-hmm. is that it kind of sucks in that you could be a songwriter. You have a melody, an idea, lyrics and stuff. But you can't be like a drummer, a bass player, a guitar player, a violinist, and a keyboardist at the same time. You sure could as a producer, like, you know, like the great producers, but it fucking sucks. It's like, I've been playing violin for 20 years. I don't need to learn drums now.
No, I don't want to learn drums either.
Hell yeah.
So yeah, that's my setup. And I kind of keep, I mean, with all the Twitch streams and the shows that I do keep the microphone set up. And so it's just kind of always ready to go. And then I have all my guitars behind me.
Nice. Yeah, I think that's a really big point and a really important thing to do, at least for me in my life. And what a lot of people ask me, I tell them, is that if you have something that's just ready to go, you're more likely going to use it.
So like much
if people
easier.
Ask what the best interface is, I'm like, well, it's the one that you have. The best camera is the one that you just might be your phone because it's there, you know, et cetera. Best guitar is the one that your neighbor lets you borrow, like, you know, et cetera, et cetera. Mm-hmm. And I think that as far as the vibe of 2020 has learned, and hopefully the going forward, the vibe of 2021 is just let it be easy. Like, what does it look like?
It doesn't have to be expensive.
Yeah.
At all.
No, especially with today's technology, the best, you know, a $300 or $400 microphone today or cheaper is as good as like the best one mm-hmm. was a little while ago. But yeah, I was hoping to pivot a little bit to some weird shit.
Sure.
Now, I know that you are into some of the same things as I am. We talked previously earlier about a little bit of reincarnation ideas. I know you've got a penchant for the tarot cards and things like that. But did you have any, what were the urban legends where you grew up? In Syracuse, right?
In Syracuse, yeah.
Who were the kids afraid of?
There is a spot called 13 Curves, where I don't fucking remember where exactly it is, but it was this street that was really notoriously shitty, especially in the wintertime, because it was 13 curves. And apparently, folklore was that there was this old, like this couple on the night of their wedding got into a car accident. And so when you're driving around the 13th curve, you'll see the woman in her wedding dress. That was the big one. And then
we had almost an identical one, you know, 200 miles away from you guys. So it's just glad to know that everybody's telling each other the same stories.
Yeah, there's the same. My parents had a cabin up in the Adirondacks, which is where they live now. And up in Big Moose, there is this hotel that is just notoriously haunted. And apparently you can see the woman who died on her wedding night in her wedding dress floating in Big Moose Lake.
Amazing.
But that to me, way scarier. I've always been like a lake swimmer.
Oh, fuck that. I can't. Side note, I will jump in the lake mostly because I don't want anyone to see my fear and then be able to exploit me later. But I cannot stand getting in water where you can't see what's underneath you.
But that's the problem with that ghost story. And also, I mean, I grew up in like around lakes, so lake swimming was never a problem to me. And then my sister lives in Chattanooga, and we go paddleboarding in the river. And then I went to the aquarium like a week later and found that they did an exhibit on the creatures that live in the river. I haven't gone in the river since. They look like eels with teeth, and it's terrifying.
Yeah, that's horrifying. Are they musks or musks? Isn't there like a big fish? I'm going to fuck this up. There's a big fish that kind of looks like it.
Yeah, I'm sure you're talking about the same one that I am.
Yeah.
It's just scary. And then we had something hollow, and I can't remember what it's called, where it's like a bird watching place, but apparently there used to be like a bunch of witch burnings and things like that out in the woods.
I think our generation caught the ass end or were kids during the satanic panic. You know, I feel like everybody had a different devil worshiper situation or story or place in the woods. And people would be like, I saw guys with robes in there one night. And it's like, oh, and everyone would take it seriously, you know, and in reality it was like people with the whole, like, I don't know, suppressed memory movement on CNN where they locked all those fucking people up and shit, or 2020.
I was also fascinated, though, because I loved any place growing up where my dad told us not to go to because his mother told him not to go to it.
Whoa. I backed the shit out of that. So
and
there's
that was
so
that
many of those.
Hickory. I don't remember what hollow it was because I also lived on Smoky Hollow and I don't remember. I don't think that was it. But yeah, like my grandmother told my father, don't go there.
Yeah, that's one of the ones where despite trying to live a life rationally, I would listen. I'd be like, you know what? You said there's a reason not to go there. Who knows? Maybe there's like they have sinkholes or some shit and they just don't want you to go there. Or maybe there's some fucked up shit.
Ghosts are scary, but serial killers are the real threat.
Yeah, serial killers are much scarier. We had a very similar bride urban legend, except ours was also on a curved road called Snake Road. And there's also one on Suskin Road, but that was like for the kids who lived on, you know, the other side, the south side of Scranton.
Something
for everybody. Ours was you had to pick her up if you saw her, or you would die. So if you see her on the side of the road on her wedding night where she got killed, you had to pick her up and then drive her to where her house was, and she would let you know, and then she gets out of the car. And if you didn't, then you're cursed forever.
That's terrifying.
Yeah, a scary one.
So did any of your friends pick her up?
No.
Or say they did.
No, nobody said that they did. I think that there was a story of some kids who had one of the girls dressed up like that, and they like went out and picked her up and scared the shit out of their siblings probably for the rest of their life. Fun fact, though, on a road really close to there one time, I was with my friend, one of my best friends, Curtis, whom I played with in a band before this one, and we were driving up to his parents' house after one of us had worked. So this was like 11:30 p.m. He's a little bit older, so I was still in middle school, and he's in high school or whatever. We're driving up this road, or maybe I was in high school, I forget. We're driving up the road, and there's a woman who looked extremely distressed and disturbed in kind of like gown-ish clothing on the side of the road that were no houses there, and she was just walking down the road, and we were driving, and we just drove past her. We didn't stop. We didn't freak out. We were just like, oh my God, you see that? Keep going, keep going, keep going. And realized that it was probably someone who needed help in some capacity. It may have like left a house, but it was so fucking scary, and we were so stoned, which was really dumb, that we let her keep walking on down the road in the middle of the woods.
Damn.
Yeah.
That's
so
scary.
That was close to it. But so tarot cards. Mm-hmm. Now I heard you say a really interesting thing about tarot cards. I played this game with Beth Ann and her friends called Goddess Cards. So it's very similar to tarot cards in that each card has a meaning, and you ask a question, and then the person who's doing your reading will pull the cards out, and then you interpret the question that you ask based off of the cards.
Sure.
Now, I don't, you know, believe that the cards are being destined or have some type of like otherworldly or consciousness influenced even thing, but I do think it's a fun game, and it's also useful in the same way that you watch a movie. Like, you can look at the thing that you're talking about in a different frame. Like, if you look at the card, you don't say, oh, that means X is going to happen. It means, oh, I wonder what about this relates to that. And there's like a guide for the cards. So it's a lot more nuanced than I'm saying. But like, what do you like about that kind of shit, like tarot cards?
So I just have always had a penchant for things like that. And I guess like my upbringing, like when I was 16 and, you know, when everybody starts questioning their religious upbringings and what they choose to believe, my father decided to tell us that he thought he was Wiccan. And so like,
that's a hell of a timing for a 16-year-old girl.
Yeah, what a time. But it also just kind of opened my eyes to like whatever resonates with you and whatever kind of gives you meaning. And I've always just been fascinated by that. And so tarot cards were really fascinating to me because, you know, I've had my cards read by people in the past. Has it turned out to be true? Yes. Did I also have a real skepticism to it, to be like, did I kind of, ever since that seed was planted, did I essentially make it happen on my own anyway? Did I hear what I wanted to hear to help solidify the decisions that I made after that? Or did I not hear what I wanted to hear, so I tried harder? You know, anything like that. And what I like about tarot and kind of how I've even approached it is I started reading my cards every day as a writing prompt.
Whoa. So that's fucking cool. How did that what was your process? How did that manifest?
So basically, whenever you're doing a tarot reading, I don't necessarily view it as a fortune-telling situation. If anything, to me, from my understanding and how I'm choosing to understand this like spiritual realm, I view those cards are all just kind of chance anyways. And then whatever card you pick is also by chance. And we can decide whether or not chance is like some omniscient power forcing you or telling you or whatever, however your hand lands on the card that you flip over, you're there.
Yeah.
And I viewed that as more of like a, we're so not ever in the moment we're in anymore. We're always so incredibly distracted. We're always thinking about 30 different things. Where anytime I pick up my phone, I'm like, why did I had a reason, but I don't remember what it is. And so I use tarot as a means to draw a card and meditate on whatever it means for my life at that point in time. And oftentimes it forces me, like the meaning of the card, to think about a specific thing that maybe I hadn't been thinking about, or maybe it's, you know, talking about abundance or things like that, things that I'm, you know, as I suffer through anxiety and depression in this fucking hellhole, not my house, just the year as a whole is a hellhole. you think about specific things that weren't on your subconscious, just there. So I just decided to start doing like a brain dump every time I would do the card, and I would find out what it meant, and then I would just write like 2 or 3 pages every day, especially while I was on tour, about what it meant and like what I was thinking, what it brought to mind in my life.
Yeah.
And I view tarot more as like a meditation, kind of like making a gratitude list, kind of like doing a brain dump, kind of like journaling. But the card itself pointed the direction.
I think that's so cool and fantastic, because it is a practical use of it. I mean, it's a practical practice that you are inspiring yourself and continuing to be creative and shaping the way that you think about the world. And there's still that slightly little spooky element about it that you get to keep. So you get to be like, well, weird that I pulled this card today because this
exactly.
is happening. Or the same thing happens later, which of course there's, you know, as far as what we know about the physical and, you know, and non-physical world, there's no reason to think that, there's no proof that they are connected, but I like that spooky shit, and I have been shown in my life over and over again, even if it's just my brain recognizing patterns, that there are these slight synchronicitous things that happen, and I think that you can increase the likelihood of those things happening by practicing stuff like that.
And
like
being
practicing
open
your
to
thinking.
It.
Out.
Yeah.
What, that's it. Being open to it is what it is. So
here's the thing, is that anytime you draw a card and you decide to write about it, how it pertains to your life, it's true. So there's never going to be a drawing that's untrue.
You're right. You self-fulfill it. You make it true. Yeah.
You know, and I genuinely believe that there are people who are very gifted at reading tarot cards and putting the cards together. But no matter what combination yes, there will be times when it's eerily on point with what you're going through. But yeah. There's also, to some degree, we're all experiencing all of these things, whether or not it's on the same level, like a death or a breakup or just like an inconvenience that bummed you out for the day. You know, like good or bad, you can basically apply whatever comes up to your life.
Yeah.
So I think that the power in that is, you know, maybe the magic that I like to believe is like, this is what you should focus on today. So spend the day just thinking about this. Or sometimes if I find my mind wandering, I try to go back to the card or like, and have that kind of be like a mantra where, similar to meditation, you just go back to something whenever you find yourself drifting.
Wow. That's amazing. And there's like, I don't know the history of tarot cards, but I believe that they've probably been used in a similar fashion with the same things on them, with the same kind of framework, like you're mentioning, for a very long time.
Yeah.
You know, not everything that's old is great. There's a lot of institutions that aren't so good and thought processes, but some of these little practices that people have used for a very long time do hold weight in those regards, and they can
be used. And also, it's not always like whenever you draw like the death card or the hangman or something like that, like, you know, so many movies make it sound like, oh my God, I'm going to die, or, you know, things like that. And I think that if you took the mentality of trying to pertain it to like more of the spiritual side of your life, like what is ending, what needs to end, or the hangman, you are just kind of deeming yourself helpless in this moment. What should you focus on?
Yeah, and that death that you're talking about doesn't necessarily mean that something has to die because you drew the card.
It's right.
There's already something there. Maybe today is the day that you think about.
And how
that
inspiring
thing.
Is that? Yeah. If like you start your day seeing something like, okay, something needs to get cut because it's not serving you anymore.
Yeah.
So I like to use that as writing prompts because, you know, I don't know about you, but like I have a fucking hard time writing, especially right now. Like the creative juices are not flowing. So sometimes like if I can find a way to inspire myself to just focus on something, then I go back and read every week or so everything that I wrote and highlight some lines that I was like, ooh, I like that. That's good. Or why don't I write a song about this? This is cool.
Just totally
see what happens.
Yeah, I back that. For me to get into writing, like you're mentioning, is having this some kind of practice or something, making it interesting. There's been so many times where I've caught myself and been like, I haven't written a word or a lyric or a chord in like a week, you know, and like I just feel shitty and realize that that's why I feel shitty. I'm not blaming the circumstances.
You know, there's a digital tarot deck. Just get a daily card and just like use it as a writing prompt.
That's such a good idea. I'm actually gonna try that for sure for a week. That's what the 2021 is gonna be for me, is random weird experiments.
Yeah.
And not the wrong kind of weird, the great kind of weird. And I'm gonna try that for 7 days.
It's pretty cool.
Pull a tarot card, write about it.
Yeah.
Sounds great.
It's real introspective. But like, it's not the same kind of, I don't know, for me personally, whenever I try and write introspective, it's always kind of the same thing. So it gives me like different, kind of like Picasso, just looking at it from a different angle.
Love that, to be shaken out of it. And we've done over an hour already, so thank you so much for coming on. But
speaking of
being shaken out of, what do you have coming up? How does someone watch the Kelly G Show? And more importantly, how do you feel that your creative processes this coming year are going to be shaken out of what happened last year, as we get into touring, hopefully in the fall. I'll knock on every piece of wood in my house.
I will,
you know,
too.
Like what are you gonna take away? It's a big question.
And yeah, really it
kind
is
of an obnoxious question, but what
Well, it's funny because I feel like I spent 6 to 8 months of 2020 very much like a child having a tantrum where I was just pissed. I wasn't lashing out by any stretch of the imagination, but I wasn't doing anything about like making lemonade. I was just pissed at all these lemons, you know? And because I got in the studio in January and recorded a record with Will. And to this day, it's about as known as it was on January 4th of last year, you know?
Speared.
Yeah. So I think I spent like the first half of the year in like a depression of not knowing what to do with the lack of. And then I spent the second half of the year learning that the lack of live music and my ability to release my music kind of gave me the space to figure out something new to do with it. So I started the show. I also started the podcast with Dave Hidalgo Jr. called Friends with Benedict, where we talk about tour and food, which you are on, second episode. And we're gearing up to do a second season of that this spring. And I just wanted to find a reason to play music again because I felt very lost. And I miss talking to my friends, so I wanted to do some variety show. And I really missed the community of live shows. And playing a song for the green dot on my computer really wasn't cutting it, but I also knew I didn't really want to do it live because you can't read the chat, you can't talk to people, you can't kind of have that moment, and you can't be in the moment of playing music while you're also trying to read. Like,
sure.
That's just insane. So I started doing the show, and then I started learning how to use Twitch. And now I do Twitch, and I have like a digital hangout for that. I just started using Discord.
Very cool.
None of these things pay, but and require an awful lot of work. But I'm really excited about this community that's building around these shared missed experiences. And I really love the fact that, you know, people are becoming friends because they were on Twitch on my live stream, or, you know, are on Discord. And I think that that kind of, like, it's kind of like meeting people at a show, or kind of like bumping people at a show, and you like say hey, and that sort of community is just gone right now. And it's something that, like, whether you're a social being or not, I find that I am just missing other people.
Yeah.
You know, and I'm not a very social person at all, but, like, geez, I haven't seen a stranger smile in a long time.
Yeah, we are raging against hundreds of thousands of years of evolutionary biology.
Yeah, I think that we can't not miss that to some degree. So I think I've kind of latched onto my silver lining, where, like, I'm happy to go online once a week or twice a week and talk to people and play music. And I think it's going to, you know, once we're able to have shows again, I think I've given people like a glimpse of my real life. And I think that, you know, not that I consider myself any level of celebrity whatsoever, but I also think that it's important to remember, especially after the year that we've all had, that every musician that you like is a normal person that went through something really difficult. And learning about their personal lives to some degree, you know, obviously I don't want to be a completely open book. I like having my life be private, but, you know, you feel closer to the people that support you. And yeah. I think that that's only going to continue to create a better bond when you're actually able to do a show again. Because when I play shows anyways, like, I ramble like an idiot. I embarrass myself relentlessly, but I have always tried to, like, decrease the distance between the audience and myself.
Sure.
I don't want people to think that I'm far away. And if anything, all of these avenues that I've taken during this year have really kind of, like, taken that barrier down so that people know me now. And people, you know, I like that. Again, it's not 100%. Like,
totally.
Nobody knows my innermost thoughts or deeper workings. But I also think it's super important that people get to know that these people, you know, we write, we create music, we have very, like, fortunate and lucky lives where we travel the world and get to play music for people as our job. But, like, it's also been a really weird year.
Yeah, one of the, you know, weirdest for sure in our lives. I really hope that the idea of having that shared experience that you're mentioning brings you and your audience closer to each other is something that extrapolates out into creating somewhat of a national identity. I hope that,
sure,
and global, but just because of the deep divides, you know, true and perceived and, you know, exacerbated on social media and Twitter and bizarre places like that, I'm hoping that after the pandemic is over, because everyone had gone through this experience, they immediately have a deeply emotional similarity. They have,
sure,
something in common that they experience that is rings with them and resonates with them at a core level of how they define themselves. So you can think of someone in all the divisions that you want, whether it's the way they think or how they look or how they sound, But in reality, we all did the same thing. So it's like, oh, hey, geez, remember when everybody bought all the toilet paper? You know, like that's the first thing that you could connect with someone with.
Right. And I mean, I'm sure you feel it too with everything that you've been doing with this and the Patreon and things like that. It's something that I never thought I would be like all in on. And it's really exciting. I mean, I have to do a separate Twitch at 2 p.m. on a Friday because that's when people from Russia can talk to me. And I'm like,
it's amazing.
Like, and that's, it's, I've never, like, I've played with Frank in Russia, but like, I've never had my music played in Russia, and now they're watching my show, and now it's like, it's crazy to me, like how we're all missing the same things.
Totally. And all going to be, since we're missing them, we're all experiencing that loss and getting tied together.
Yeah. So,
it's gonna be weird. It's gonna be weird going out there. I wonder when the next time I'm gonna hug a stranger is.
Right.
Or even hug one of my friends.
I feel like we're all gonna have a little bit of like PTSD, like not sure what's safe and what's not when we can do all of these things again.
Oh yeah. I absolutely agree. And I think that when it's over, some of us are gonna be like rubber bands just snapping all the way to the other side. It's gonna be
I had a chat with one of my friends who's like, I think that we're gonna like live harder than we've ever lived before.
Oh yeah.
And I'm like, yeah, that I am pretty sure that as soon as this is unleashed, like there will be no girls weekend that I will not attend. There will
exactly.
be no wedding overseas that I will not fly to, you know.
Yeah, it's gonna be a roaring 20s. I hope there's not gonna be any like the glorification of like the stay in bed meme that you would see people posting on Instagram before will be no longer. There will
do
be
I
no
ever
more
think I will blow wine. Out a birthday cake ever again? Probably not. I don't think any of us ever will, to be honest. I think about that often. Like, the next time someone passes you a bottle, will you drink out of it? Or will
That's
you
what
be
I'm
like,
saying.
Dude, let's get the cups.
Some people are going to go twice as hard. Some people are going to be like, never again. But I think, hopefully, at least, I was talking to Chris Cresswell about it. Some of us, for sure, and I hope societally will, if you're sick, you'll see somebody, you're going to see more people with masks on at the grocery store next year because they have a cold. Than you did before. So it was very prominent in like the Asian community in Philadelphia and you know, other places I'd been to, hospitals. When I was a delivery guy out and I did bicycle delivery in West Philly for a couple of years, and you'd see random people with masks on, and it was to protect other people from, you know, sneezing on each other. I think that's going to be a very integral part of our society going
forward.
Do you
think you'd wear them on planes? Because I feel like I might just do it.
I would no. I after reading about what they've done on the planes, no. The way
that's true.
Yeah,
actually,
so I'm
right.
just like yeah. But would I wear it on
if
a
I'm
bus?
I'm on a Greyhound. Yeah.
Maybe I would.
Why not?
I love it. But thank you so very much for joining me.
Oh, and, thanks so much for having me.
I can't wait to catch
this
the next
great.
Show. Yeah. And until next time, we come back on again. I always have to ask somebody this while they're being recorded, so that they say yes, and then I have the record of it.
Absolutely. This has been a lot of fun to talk to you.
Hell yeah. Thank you so much. We'll talk to you soon.
All righty.
All right. Another massive thanks to Kaylee for coming on, and a huge thanks to you for listening. Got some changes coming up that I'm really excited about. We're going to play around the format a little bit. I love to say that because it's so ambiguous. It makes me sound like I'm doing more than I'm doing. We're playing around the format a little bit, but you'll see. We got some fun episodes that are coming up. Please email me, tom@futurefriday.net. I would love to hear from you. And unless the email falls through the cracks because I'm working on something ridiculous and I'm getting an enormous amount of emails from something wild, I'll tell the story on the podcast eventually. But give me an email, tom@futurefriday.net. I'll get back to you. Let me know who you want to hear on the show. I'm having a good time with this. I'm really excited to see what comes up in the future. So have a great rest of your day. Goodbye.
This is Krista Makes, guitarist and vocalist for Less Than Jake, and host of Krista Makes a Podcast, a songwriting podcast where every week I'm joined by an amazing guest to break down the writing, recording, and release of one iconic song from their career. In our giant evergreen back catalog of episodes, we've had rock legends such as Dee Snider and Huey Lewis, punk rock favorites like Mark Hoppus, Fat Mike, and Brett Gurewitz, and up-and-coming artists of today such as Liz Stokes of the Beths and Genesis Owusu. We've had guests from all genres and styles of music, and I guarantee that if you peruse our back catalog, you'll see several episodes that'll make you say, "Man, I gotta hear that." Whether you're a fan of music or a creator of music yourself, you'll take away a whole new appreciation for the songs you know and love. Krista Makes a Podcast is available for free on all the places you could possibly listen to podcasts, and new episodes come out every Monday.
Well, hey friends, my name is Zach Lupitin. You may know me from the band Dust Bowl Revival, but I also host a music discovery podcast called The Show on the Road. For the last 5 seasons, I've been able to dive deep and have intimate chats with folks like The Lumineers, Ani DeFranco, Wolf Peck, Keb Moe, Lake Street Dive, Bela Fleck, and more. So guess what? After 150 conversations with some of my favorite songwriters from around the world, we are bringing brand new episodes to the Osiris Network. New interviews and intimate acoustic performances will be coming at you this summer. And which episodes are coming next, you ask?
I am Zach Goody, the lead singer for the band Smash Mouth.
Our band is called Milky Chance. We are based in Berlin.
My name is David Shaw. I sing and write songs with my band, The Revivalists.
Trust me, these conversations go some wild places. So subscribe to The Show on the Road on Osiris, and we'll see you soon. Again.